This audio program is brought to you courtesy of Audible.com. Audible, audio that speaks to you wherever you are.
The Lost Continent, Travels in Small Town America, by Bill Bryson. Read by William Roberts. Part 1. East. Chapter 1. I come from Des Moines. Somebody had to. When you come from Des Moines, you either accept the fact without question and settle down with a local girl named Bobby and get a job at the Firestone factory and live there forever and ever, or you spend your adolescence moaning at length about what a dump it is and how you can't wait to get out, and then you settle down with a local girl named Bobby and get a job at the Firestone factory and live there forever and ever. Hardly anyone ever leaves. This is because Des Moines is the most powerful hypnotic known to man. Outside town, there is a big sign that says, "Welcome to Des Moines. This is what death is like." There isn't really. I just made that up. But the place does get a grip on you. People who have nothing to do with Des Moines drive in off the interstate looking for gas or hamburgers and stay forever. There's a New Jersey couple up the street from my parents' house whom you see wandering around from time to time looking faintly puzzled but strangely serene. Everybody in Des Moines is strangely serene. The only person I ever knew in Des Moines who wasn't serene was Mr. Piper. Mr. Piper was my parents' neighbor, a leering, cheery-faced idiot who was forever getting drunk and crashing his car into telephone poles. Everywhere you went, you encountered telephone poles and road signs leaning dangerously in testimony to Mr. Piper's driving habits. He distributed them all over the west side of town, rather in the way dogs mark trees. Mr. Piper was the nearest possible human equivalent to Fred Flintstone, but less charming. He was a Shriner and a Republican, a Nixon Republican, and he appeared to feel he had a mission in life to spread offense. His favorite pastime, apart from getting drunk and crashing his car, was to get drunk and insult the neighbors, particularly us because we were Democrats, though he was prepared to insult Republicans when we weren't available. Eventually I grew up and moved to England. This irritated Mr. Piper almost beyond measure. It was worse than being a Democrat. Whenever I was in town, Mr. Piper would come over and chide me. "I don't know what you're doing over there with all those limeys," he would say provocatively. "They're not clean people." "Mr. Piper, you don't know what you're talking about," I would reply in my affected English accent. "You are a cretin." You could talk like that to Mr. Piper because, one, he was a cretin, and, two, he never listened to anything that was said to him. "Bobby and I went over to London 2 years ago, and our hotel room didn't even have a bathroom in it," Mr. Piper would go on. "If you wanted to take a leak in the middle of the night, you had to walk about a mile down the hallway. That isn't a clean way to live." Mr. Piper, the English are paragons of cleanliness. It is a well-known fact that they use more soap per capita than anyone else in Europe. Mr. Piper would snort derisively at this. "That doesn't mean diddly-squat, boy, just because they're cleaner than a bunch of krauts and eye-ties. My God, a dog's cleaner than a bunch of krauts and eye-ties. And I'll tell you something else. If his daddy hadn't bought Illinois for him, John F. Kennedy would never have been elected president." I had lived around Mr. Piper long enough not to be thrown by this abrupt change of tack. The theft of the 1960 presidential election was a long-standing plaint of his, one that he brought into the conversation every 10 or 12 minutes, regardless of the prevailing drift of the discussion. In 1963, during Kennedy's funeral, someone in the Waveland tap punched Mr. Piper in the nose for making that remark. Mr. Piper was so furious that he went straight out and crashed his car into a telephone pole. Mr. Piper is dead now, which is, of course, one thing that Des Moines prepares you for. When I was growing up, I used to think that the best thing about coming from Des Moines was that it meant you didn't come from anywhere else in Iowa. By Iowa standards, Des Moines is a mecca of cosmopolitanism, a dynamic hub of wealth and education, where people wear three-piece suits and dark socks, often simultaneously. During the annual state high school basketball tournament, when the hayseeds from out in the state would flood into the city for a week, we used to accost them downtown and snidely offer to show them how to ride an escalator or negotiate a revolving door. This wasn't always so far from reality. My friend Stan, when he was about 16, had to go and stay with his cousin in some remote, dusty hamlet called Dogwater or Dunceville or some such improbable spot, the kind of place where if a dog gets run over by a truck, everybody goes out to have a look at it.
By the second week, delirious with boredom, Stan insisted that he and his cousin drive the 50 miles into the county town, Hooterville, and find something to do. They went bowling at an alley with warped lanes and chipped balls, and afterwards had a chocolate soda and looked at a Playboy in a drugstore. And on the way home, the cousin sighed with immense satisfaction and said,
"Gee, thanks, Stan. That was the best time I ever had in my whole life."
It's true. I had to drive to Minneapolis once, and I went on a back road just to see the country. But there was nothing to see. It's just flat and hot and full of corn and soya beans and hogs. Every once in a while you come across a farm or some dead little town where the liveliest thing is the flies. I remember one long, shimmering stretch where I could see a couple of miles down the highway, and there was a brown dot beside the road. As I got closer, I saw it was a man sitting on a box by his front yard, in some six-house town with a name like Spigot or Urinal, watching my approach with an inordinate interest. He watched me zip past, and in the rearview mirror I could see him still watching me going on down the road, until at last I disappeared into a heat haze. The whole thing must have taken about 5 minutes. I wouldn't be surprised if even now he thinks of me from time to time. He was wearing a baseball cap. You can always spot an Iowa man because he's wearing a baseball cap advertising John Deere or a feed company, and because the back of his neck has been lasered into deep crevasses by years of driving a John Deere tractor back and forth in a blazing sun. This does not do his mind a whole lot of good either. His other distinguishing feature is that he looks ridiculous when he takes off his shirt because his neck and arms are chocolate brown and his torso is as white as a sow's belly. In Iowa, it's called a farmer's tan, and it is, I believe, a badge of distinction. Iowa women are almost always sensationally overweight. You see them at Merle Hay Mall in Des Moines on Saturdays, clammy and meaty in their shorts and halter tops, looking a little like elephants dressed in children's clothes, yelling at their kids, calling out names like Dwayne and Shauna. Jack Kerouac, of all people, thought that Iowa women were the prettiest in the country, but I don't think he ever went to Merle Hay Mall on a Saturday. I will say this, however, and it's a strange, strange thing. The teenage daughters of these fat women are always utterly delectable, as soft and gloriously rounded and naturally fresh-smelling as a basket of fruit. I don't know what it is that happens to them, but it must be awful to marry one of those nubile cuties, knowing that there is a time bomb ticking away in her that will at some unknown date make her bloat out into something huge and grotesque, presumably all of a sudden and without much notice, like a self-inflating raft from which the stopper has been yanked. Even without this inducement, I don't think I would have stayed in Iowa. I never felt altogether at home there, even when I was small. In about 1957, my grandparents gave me a Viewmaster for my birthday and a packet of discs with the title, Iowa, Our Glorious State. I can remember thinking even then that the selection of glories was a trifle on the thin side. With no natural features of note, no national parks, no battlefields or famous birthplaces, the Viewmaster people had to stretch their creative 3D talents to the full. Putting the Viewmaster to your eyes and clicking the white handle gave you, as I recall, a shot of Herbert Hoover's birthplace, impressively three-dimensional, followed by Iowa's other great treasure, the little brown church in the Vale, which inspired the song whose tune nobody ever quite knows, the highway bridge over the Mississippi River at Davenport, all the cars seem to be hurrying towards Illinois, a field of waving corn, the bridge over the Missouri River at Council Bluffs, and the little brown church in the Vale again, taken from another angle. I can remember thinking even then that there must be more to life than that. Then one gray Sunday afternoon, when I was about 10, I was watching TV, and there was a documentary on about movie-making in Europe. One clip showed Anthony Perkins walking along some sloping city street at dusk. I don't remember now if it was Rome or Paris, but the street was cobbled and shiny with rain, and Perkins was hunched deep in a trench coat, and I thought, hey, c'est moi! I began to read, no, I began to consume National Geographic's with their pictures of glowing Lapps and mist-shrouded castles and ancient cities of infinite charm. From that moment, I wanted to be a European boy. I wanted to live in an apartment across from a park in the heart of a city and from my bedroom window look out on a crowded vista of hills and rooftops. I wanted to ride trams and understand strange languages. I wanted friends named Werner and Marco, who wore short pants and played soccer in the street and owned toys made of wood. I cannot for the life of me think why. I wanted my mother to send me out to buy long loaves of bread from a shop with a wooden pretzel hanging above the entrance. I wanted to step outside my front door and be somewhere. As soon as I was old enough, I left. I left Des Moines and Iowa and the United States and the war in Vietnam and Watergate and settled across the world. And now when I came home, it was to a foreign country full of serial murderers and sports teams in the wrong towns, the Indianapolis Colts, the Toronto Blue Jays, and a personable old fart who was president. My mother knew that personable old fart when he was a sportscaster called Dutch Reagan at WHO Radio in Des Moines. He was just a nice, friendly, kind of dopey guy, my mother says. Which, come to that, is a pretty fair description of most Iowans. Don't get me wrong. I am not for a moment suggesting that Iowans are mentally deficient. They are a decidedly intelligent and sensible people who, despite their natural conservatism, have always been prepared to elect a conscientious, clear-thinking liberal in preference to some cretinous conservative. This used to drive Mr. Piper practically insane. And Iowans, I am proud to tell you, have the highest literacy rate in the nation. 99.5% of grown-ups there can read. When I say they're kind of dopey, I mean they are trusting and amiable and open. They are a tad slow, certainly. When you tell an Iowan a joke, you can see a kind of race going on between his brain and his expression. But it's not because they're incapable of high-speed mental activity. It's only that there's not much call for it. Their wits are dulled by simple, wholesome faith in God and the soil and their fellow man. Above all, Iowans are friendly. You go into a strange diner in the South, and everything goes quiet, and you realize all the other customers are looking at you as if they were sizing up the risk involved in murdering you for your wallet and leaving your body in a shallow grave somewhere out in the swamps. In Iowa, you are the center of attention. The most interesting thing to hit town since a tornado carried off old Frank Sprinkle and his tractor last May. Everybody you meet acts like he would gladly give you his last beer and let you sleep with his sister. Everyone is happy and friendly and strangely serene. The last time I was home, I went to Kresge's downtown and bought a bunch of postcards to send back to England. I bought the most ridiculous ones I could find. A sunset over a feed lot, a picture of farmers bravely grasping a moving staircase beside the caption, "We rode the escalator at Merle Hay Mall," that sort of thing. They were so uniformly absurd that when I took them up to the checkout, I felt embarrassed by them, as if I were buying dirty magazines, and hoped somehow to convey the impression that they weren't really for me. But the checkout lady regarded each of them with interest and deliberation, just as they always do with dirty magazines, come to that. When she looked up at me, she was almost misty-eyed. She wore butterfly glasses and a beehive hairdo. "Those are real nice," she said. "You know, honey, I've been in a lot of states and seen a lot of places, but I can tell you that this is just about the purtiest one I ever saw." She really said purtiest. She really meant it. The poor woman was in a state of terminal hypnosis. I glanced at the cards, and to my surprise, I suddenly saw what she meant. I couldn't help but agree with her. They were purty. Together we made a little pool of silent admiration. For one giddy, careless moment, I was almost serene myself. It was a strange sensation, and it soon passed. My father liked Iowa. He lived his whole life in the state, and is even now working his way through eternity there in Glendale Cemetery in Des Moines. But every year he became seized with a quietly maniacal urge to get out of the state and go on vacation. Every summer, without a whole lot of notice, he would load the car to groaning, hurry us into it, take off for some distant point, return to get his wallet after having driven almost to the next state, and take off again for some distant point. Every year it was the same. Every year it was awful. The big killer was the tedium. Iowa is in the middle of the biggest plain this side of Jupiter. Climb onto a rooftop almost anywhere in the state, and you are confronted with a featureless sweep of corn for as far as the eye can see. It is 1,000 miles from the sea, in any direction. 400 miles from the nearest mountain, 300 miles from skyscrapers and muggers and things of interest, 200 miles from people who do not habitually stick a finger in their ear and swivel it around as a preliminary to answering any question addressed to them by a stranger. To reach anywhere of even passing interest from Des Moines by car requires a journey that in other countries would be considered epic. It means days and days of unrelenting tedium in a baking steel capsule on a ribbon of highway. In my memory, our vacations were always taken in a big blue Rambler station wagon. It was a cruddy car. My dad always bought cruddy cars, until he got to the male menopause and started buying zippy red convertibles. But it had the great virtue of space. My brother, sister, and I in the back were miles away from my parents up front, in effect, in another room. We quickly discovered during illicit forays into the picnic hamper that if you stuck a bunch of Ohio blue-tip matches into an apple or hard-boiled egg so that it resembled a porcupine and casually dropped it out the tailgate window, it was like a bomb. It would explode with a small bang and a surprisingly big flash of blue flame, causing cars following behind to veer in an amusing fashion. My dad, miles away up front, never knew what was going on, and could not understand why all day long cars would zoom up alongside him with the driver gesticulating furiously before tearing off into the distance. "What was that all about?" he would say to my mother in a wounded tone. "I don't know, dear," my mother would answer mildly. My mother only ever said two things. She said, "I don't know, dear," and she said, "Can I get you a sandwich, honey?" Occasionally on our trips she would volunteer other pieces of intelligence, like, "Should that dashboard light be glowing like that, dear?" Or, "I think you hit that dog, stroke man, stroke blind person back there, honey." But mostly, she wisely kept quiet. This was because on vacations my father was a man obsessed. His principal obsession was with trying to economize. He always took us to the crummiest hotels and motor lodges, and to the kind of roadside eating houses where they only washed the dishes weekly. You always knew, with a sense of doom, that at some point before finishing you were going to discover someone else's congealed egg yolk lurking somewhere on your plate or plugged between the tines of your fork. This, of course, meant cooties and a long, painful death. But even that was a relative treat. Usually we were forced to picnic by the side of the road. My father had an instinct for picking bad picnic sites. On the apron of a busy truck stop, or in a little park that turned out to be in the heart of some seriously deprived ghetto, so that groups of children would come and stand silently by our table and watch us eating Hostess cupcakes and crinkle-cut potato chips, and it always became incredibly windy the moment we stopped, so that my mother spent the whole of lunchtime chasing paper plates over an area of about an acre. In 1957, my father invested $19.98 in a portable gas stove that took an hour to assemble before each use, and was so wildly temperamental that we children were always ordered to stand well back when it was being lit. This always proved unnecessary, however, because the stove would flicker to life only for a few seconds before puttering out, and my father would spend many hours turning it this way and that to keep it out of the wind, simultaneously addressing it in a low, agitated tone normally associated with the chronically insane. All the while, my brother, sister, and I would implore him to take us someplace with air conditioning, linen tablecloths, and ice cubes clinking in glasses of clear water. "Dad," we would beg, "you're a successful man. You make a good living. Take us to a Howard Johnson's." But he wouldn't have it. He was a child of the Depression, and where capital outlays were involved, he always wore the haunted look of a fugitive who has just heard bloodhounds in the distance. Eventually, with the sun low in the sky, he would hand us hamburgers that were cold and raw and smelled of butane. We would take one bite and refuse to eat any more. So my father would lose his temper and throw everything into the car and drive us at high speed to some roadside diner where a sweaty man with a floppy hat would sling hash while grease fires danced on his grill. And afterwards, in a silent car filled with bitterness and unquenched basic needs, we would mistakenly turn off the main highway and get lost, and end up in some no-hope hamlet with a name like Drano, Indiana, or Tapwater, Missouri, and get a room in the only hotel in town, a sort of run-down place where, if you wanted to watch TV, it meant you had to sit in the lobby and share a cracked leatherette sofa with an old man with big sweat circles under his arms. The old man would almost certainly have only one leg, and probably one other truly arresting deficiency, like no nose, or a caved-in forehead, which meant that although you were sincerely intent on watching Laramie or our Miss Brooks, you found your gaze being drawn ineluctably and sneakily to the amazing eaten-away body sitting beside you. You couldn't help yourself. Occasionally the man would turn out to have no tongue, in which case he would try to engage you in lively conversation. It was all most unsatisfying. After a week or so of this kind of searing torment, we would fetch up at some blue and glinting sweep of lake or sea in a bowl of pine-clad mountains, a place full of swings and amusements and the gay shrieks of children splashing in water, and it would all almost be worth it. Dad would become funny and warm, and even once or twice might take us out to the sort of restaurant where you didn't have to watch your food being cooked, and where the glass of water they served you wasn't autographed with lipstick. This was living. This was heady opulence. It was against this disturbed and erratic background that I became gripped with a curious urge to go back to the land of my youth and make what the blurb writers like to call a journey of discovery. On another continent, 4,000 miles away, I became quietly seized with that nostalgia that overcomes you when you have reached the middle of your life and your father has recently died, and it dawns on you that when he went, he took some of you with him. I wanted to go back to the magic places of my youth, to Mackinac Island, the Rocky Mountains, Gettysburg, and see if they were as good as I remembered them. I wanted to hear the long, low sound of a Rock Island locomotive calling across a still night and the clack of it receding into the distance. I wanted to see lightning bugs and hear cicadas shrill and be inescapably immersed in that hot, crazy-making August weather that makes your underwear scoot up every crack and fissure and cling to you like latex and drives mild-mannered men to pull out handguns and bars and light up the night with gunfire. I wanted to look for knee-high pop and Burma shave signs and go to a ball game and sit at a marble-topped soda fountain and drive through the kind of small towns that Deanna Durbin and Mickey Rooney used to inhabit in the movies. I wanted to travel around. I wanted to see America. I wanted to come home. So, I flew to Des Moines and acquired a sheaf of road maps, which I studied and puzzled over on the living room floor, drawing an immense circular itinerary that would take me all over this strange and giant semi-foreign land. My mother, meantime, made me sandwiches and said, "Oh, I don't know, dear," when I asked her questions about the vacations of my childhood. And one September dawn, in my 36th year, I crept out of my childhood home, slid behind the wheel of an aging Chevrolet Chevette lent me by my sainted and trusting mother, and guided it out through the flat, sleeping streets of the city. I cruised down an empty freeway, the only person with a mission in a city of 250,000 sleeping souls. The sun was already high in the sky and promised a blisteringly hot day. Ahead of me lay about 1,000,000 square miles of quietly rustling corn. At the edge of town, I joined Iowa Highway 163, and with a light heart, headed towards Missouri. And it isn't often you hear anyone say that. Chapter 2. In Britain, it had been a year without summer. Wet spring had merged imperceptibly into bleak autumn. For months, the sky had remained a depthless gray. Sometimes it rained, but mostly it was just dull, a land without shadows. It was like living inside Tupperware. And here, suddenly, the sun was dazzling in its intensity. Iowa was hysterical with color and light. Roadside barns were a glossy red, the sky a deep, hypnotic blue. Fields of mustard and green stretched out before me. Flecks of mica glittered in the rolling road. And here and there in the distance, mighty grain elevators, the cathedrals of the Middle West, the ships of the prairie seas, drew the sun's light and bounced it back as pure white. Squinting in the unaccustomed brilliance, I followed the highway to Otley. My intention was to retrace the route my father always took to my grandparents' house in Winfield, through Prairie City, Pella, Oskaloosa, Hedrick, Brighton, Coppock, Wayland, and Olds. The sequence was tattooed on my memory. Always having been a passenger before, I had never paid much attention to the road, so I was surprised to find I kept coming up against odd turns and abrupt T-junctions, requiring me to go left here for a couple of miles, then right for a few miles, then left again, and so on. It would have been much more straightforward to take Highway 92 to Ainsworth and then head south to Mount Pleasant. I couldn't imagine by what method of reasoning my father had ever settled on this route, and now, of course, I never would know. This seemed a pity, particularly as there was almost nothing he would have liked better than to cover the dining-room table with maps and consider at length possible routings. In this he was like most Midwesterners. Directions are very important to them. They have an innate need to be oriented, even in their anecdotes. Any story related by a Midwesterner will wander off at some point into a thicket of interior monologue along the lines of, "We were staying at a hotel that was 8 blocks northeast of the state capitol building. Come to think of it, it was northwest. And I think it was probably more like 9 blocks. And this woman without any clothes on, naked as the day she was born, except for a coonskin cap, came running at us from the southwest. Or was it the southeast?" If there are 2 Midwesterners present, and they both witnessed the incident, you can just about write off the anecdote because they will spend the rest of the afternoon arguing points of the compass and will never get back to the original story. You can always tell a Midwestern couple in Europe because they will be standing on a traffic island in the middle of a busy intersection, looking at a wind-blown map and arguing over which way is west. European cities with their wandering streets and undisciplined alleys drive Midwesterners practically insane. This geographical obsession probably has something to do with the absence of landmarks throughout Middle America. I had forgotten just how flat and empty it is. Stand on 2 phone books almost anywhere in Iowa, and you get a view. From where I was now, I could look out on a sweep of landscape about the size of Belgium. But there was nothing on it, except for a few widely separated farms, some scattered stands of trees, and 2 water towers, brilliant silver glints, signifying distant, unseen towns. Far off in the middle distance, a cloud of dust chased a car up a gravel road. The only things that stood out from the landscape were the grain elevators, but even they looked all the same, and there was nothing much to distinguish one view from another. And it's so quiet. Apart from the ceaseless fidgeting of the corn, there is not a sound. Somebody could sneeze in a house 3 miles away and you would hear it. Bless you. Thank you. It must nearly drive you crazy to live a life so devoid of stimulus, where no passing aeroplane ever draws your gaze and no car horns honk, where time shuffles forward so slowly that you half expect to find the people still watching Ozzie and Harriet on TV and voting for Eisenhower.
I don't know how far you folks in Des Moines have got, but we're only up to 1958 here in Fudd County.
Small towns are equally unhelpful in offering distinguishing features. About all that separates them are their names. They always have a gas station, a grocery store, a grain elevator, a place selling farm equipment and fertilizers, and something improbable like a microwave oven dealer or a dry cleaner's, so you can say to yourself as you glide through town, "Now what would they be doing with a dry cleaner's in Fungus City?" Every 4th or 5th community will be a county town, built around a square. A handsome brick courthouse with a Civil War cannon and a monument to the dead of at least 2 wars will stand on one side of the square, and on the other sides will be businesses, a 5 and dime, a luncheonette, 2 banks, a hardware store, a Christian bookstore, a barber's, a couple of hairdressers, a place selling the sort of men's clothing that only someone from a very small town would wear. At least 2 of the businesses will be called Vern's. The central area of the square will be a park with fat trees and a bandstand and a pole with an American flag and scattered benches full of old men in John Deere caps sitting around talking about the days when they had something else to do other than sit around and talk about the days when they had something else to do. Time in these places creaks along. The best county town in Iowa is Pella, 40 miles southeast of Des Moines. Pella was founded by Dutch immigrants, and every May it still holds a big tulip festival, for which they get somebody important, like the mayor of The Hague, to fly in and praise their bulbs. I used to like Pella when I was little because many of the residents put little windmills in their front yards, which made it kind of interesting.
I wouldn't say it made it outstandingly interesting, but you learned from an early age to take what pleasures you could find on any trip across Iowa. Besides, Pella had a Dairy Queen on the edge of town, where my father would sometimes stop and buy us ice cream cones dipped in chocolate. And for this alone, I have always felt a special fondness for the place. So I was pleased to note, as I rolled into the town on this fine September morn, that there were still windmills whirling in many a front yard. I stopped at the square and got out to stretch my legs. Being a Sunday, the old men from the square had the day off. They would be on sleeping in front of the TV duty all day. But in every other respect, Pella was as perfect as I remembered it. The square was thick with trees and flower beds of blazing salvias and glowing marigolds. It had its own windmill, a handsome green one with white blades, nearly full-sized, standing on one corner. The stores around the square were of the cereal box architecture, favored by small-town stores throughout the Midwest, but with gingerbread cornices and other cheery embellishments. Every business had a solid, trustworthy Dutch name. Paar de Cooper's Drugstore, Jaarsma Bakery, Van Gorp Insurers, Gosselink's Christian Bookstore, Van der Plug Bakery. All were shut, of course. Sundays were still closely observed in places like Pella. Indeed, the whole town was eerily quiet. It was steeped in that kind of dead silence that makes you begin to wonder, if you are of a suitably hysterical nature, if perhaps everybody has been poisoned in the night by a leak of odorless gas, which even now could be taking insidious control of your own central nervous system, turning Pella into a kind of Pompeii of the plains. I briefly imagined people from all over coming to look at the victims and being especially enthralled at the worried-looking young man in spectacles on the town square, forever clutching his throat and trying to get his car door open. But then I saw a man walking a dog at the far end of the square and realized that any danger was safely past. I hadn't intended to linger, but it was such a splendid morning that I wandered off down a nearby street, past neat wooden-framed houses with cupolas and gables and front porches with two-seater swings that creaked in the breeze. There was no other sound apart from the scuffling of my feet through dried leaves. At the bottom of the street I came across the campus of Central College, a small institution run by the Dutch Reformed Church, with a campus of red brick buildings overlooking a serpentine with an arching wooden footbridge. The whole place was as tranquil as a double dose of Valium. It looked like the sort of tidy, friendly, clean-thinking college that Clark Kent would have attended. I crossed the bridge, and at the far side of the campus found further evidence that I was not the only living person in Pella. From an open window high up in a dormitory building came the sound of a stereo turned up far too loud. It blared for a moment, something by Frankie Goes to Hollywood, I believe. And then from someplace indiscernible there came a booming voice that said, "If you don't turn that thing the fuck off right now, I'm going to come over there and pound your head in." It was a voice of a large person, someone I fancied with a nickname Moose. Immediately the music stopped, and Pella slept again. I continued on east through Oskaloosa, Fremont, Hedrick, Martinsburg. The names were familiar, but the towns themselves awoke few memories. By this stage, on most trips, I was on the floor in a boredom-induced stupor, calling out at 15-second intervals, "How much longer? When are we going to be there? I'm bored. I feel sick. How much longer? When are we going to be there?" I vaguely recognized a bend in the road near Coppock, where we once spent 4 hours caught in a blizzard waiting for a snowplow to come through, and several spots where we had paused to let my sister throw up, including a gas station at Martinsburg, where she tumbled out of the car and was lavishly sick in the direction of a pump attendant's ankles. Boy, did that guy dance. And another at Wayland, where my father nearly left me at the side of the road after discovering that I had passed the time by working loose all the rivets on one of the back door panels, exposing an interesting view of the interior mechanism, but unfortunately rendering both the window and door forever inoperable. However, it wasn't until I reached the turning off for Winfield, just past Olds, a place where my father would announce with a sort of delirious joy that we were practically there, that I felt a pang of recognition. I had not been down this road for at least a dozen years.
but its gentle slopes and isolated farms were as familiar to me as my own left leg. My heart soared. This was like going back in time. I was about to be a boy again. Arriving in Winfield was always thrilling. Dad would turn off Highway 78 and bounce us down a rough gravel road at far too high a speed, throwing up clouds of white dust, and then, to my mother's unfailing alarm, would drive with evident insanity towards some railroad tracks and a blind bend in the road, remarking gravely, "I hope there's not a train coming." My mother didn't discover until years later that there were only two trains a day along those tracks, both in the dead of night. Beyond the tracks, standing alone in a neglected field, was a Victorian mansion like the one in the Charles Adams cartoons in The New Yorker. No one had lived in it for decades, but it was still full of furniture, under dank sheets. My sister and brother and I used to climb in through a broken window and look through trunks of musty clothes and old Collier's magazines and photographs of strangely worried-looking people. Upstairs was a bedroom in which, according to my brother, lay the shriveled body of the last occupant, a woman who had died of heartbreak after being abandoned at the altar. We never went in there, though once, when I was about four, my brother peered through the keyhole, let out a howl, cried, "She's coming!" and ran headlong down the stairs. Whimpering, I followed, squirting urine at every step. Beyond the mansion was a wide field full of black and white cows, and beyond that was my grandparents' house, pretty and white beneath a canopy of trees, with a big red barn and acres of lawn. My grandparents were always waiting at the gate. I don't know whether they could see us coming and race to their positions, or whether they just waited there hour after hour. Quite possibly the latter, because, let's face it, they didn't have a whole lot else to do. And then it would be 4 or 5 days of fun. My grandfather had a Model T Ford, which he let us kids drive around the yard, to the distress of his chickens and the older women. In the winter, he would attach a sleigh to the back and take us for long, cold rides down snowy roads. In the evenings, we would all play cards around the kitchen table and stay up late. It was always Christmas at my grandparents' house, or Thanksgiving, or the 4th of July, or somebody's birthday. There was always happiness there. When we arrived, my grandmother would scuttle off to pull something fresh baked out of the oven. This was always something unusual. My grandmother was the only person I ever knew, possibly the only person who ever lived, who actually made things from the recipes in the backs of food packets. These dishes always had names like Rice Krispies and Banana Chunks Upside Down Cake, or Del Monte Lima Bean and Pretzels Party Snacks. Generally, they consisted of suspiciously large amounts of the manufacturer's own products, usually in combinations you wouldn't think of, except perhaps in an especially severe famine. The one thing to be said for these dishes was that they were novel. When my grandmother offered you a steaming slab of cake or a wedge of pie, it might contain almost anything. Niblet sweet corn, chocolate chips, Spam, diced carrots, peanut butter. Generally, it would have some Rice Krispies in it somewhere. My grandmother was particularly partial to Rice Krispies and would add a couple of shovelfuls to whatever she made, even if the recipe didn't call for it. She was about as bad a cook as you can be without actually being hazardous. It all seems so long ago now. And it was. It was so long ago, in fact, that my grandparents had a crank telephone, the kind that hung on the wall and had a handle you turned and said, "Mabel, get me Gladys Scribbage. I want to ask her how she makes her Frosted Flakes cheese whiz party nuggets." And it would turn out that Gladys Scribbage was already listening in, or somebody else listening in would know how to make Frosted Flakes cheese whiz party nuggets. Everybody listened in. My grandmother often listened in when things were slow around the house, covering the mouthpiece with her hand and relaying to the rest of the room vivid accounts of colonic irrigations, prolapsed wombs, husbands who ran off to Burlington with a barmaid from Vern's Uptown Tavern and Supper Club, and other crises of small-town life. We always had to maintain the strictest silence during these sessions. I could never entirely understand why. Because if things got really juicy, my grandmother would often butt in. "Well, I think Merle's a real skunk," she would say. "Yes, that's right, it's Maud Bryson here, and I just want to say that I think he's an absolute stinker to do that to poor Pearl. And I'll tell you something else, Mabel.
You know you could get those support bras a dollar cheaper in Columbus Junction? In about 1962, the telephone company came and put a normal phone without a party line in my grandmother's house, possibly at the request of the rest of the town. It drove a hole right through her life, from which she never entirely recovered. I didn't really expect my grandparents to be waiting for me at the gate, on account of them both having been dead for many years, but I suppose I had vaguely hoped that another nice old couple might be living there now, and would invite me to look around and share my reminiscences. Perhaps they would let me be their grandson. At the very least, I had assumed that my grandparents' house would be just as I had last seen it. It was not to be. The road leading to the house was still graveled with gleaming gypsum pebbles and still threw up satisfying clouds of dust, but the railroad tracks were gone. There was no sign that they had ever been there. The Victorian mansion was gone, too, replaced by a ranch house-style home with cars and propane gas cylinders scattered around the yard like a toddler's playthings. Worse still, the field of cows was now in a state of box houses. My grandparents' home had stood well outside the town, a cool island of trees in an ocean of fields. Now cheap little houses crowded in on it from all sides. With shock, I realized that the barn was gone. Some jerk had torn down my barn. And the house itself, well, it was a shack. Paint had abandoned it in chunks. Bushes had been pointlessly uprooted, trees chopped down. The grass was high and littered with overspill from the house. I stopped the car on the road out front and just gaped. I cannot describe the sense of loss. Half my memories were inside that house. After a moment, a hugely overweight woman in pink shorts, talking on a phone with an apparently endless cord, came and stood in the open doorway and stared at me, wondering what I was doing staring at her. I drove on into the town. When I was growing up, Main Street in Winfield had two grocery stores, a variety store, a tavern, a pool hall, a newspaper, a bank, a barber shop, a post office, two gas stations, all the things you would expect of any thriving little town. Everyone shopped locally. Everyone knew everyone else. Now, all that was left was a tavern and a place selling farm equipment. There were half a dozen vacant lots full of patchy grass, where buildings had been torn down and never replaced. Most of the remaining buildings were dark and boarded up. It was like an abandoned film set, which had long since been left to decay. I couldn't understand what had happened. People now must have to drive 30 miles to buy a loaf of bread. Outside the tavern, a group of young, thuggy-looking motorcyclists were hanging out. I was going to stop to ask them what had happened to their town, but one of them, seeing me slow down, gave me the finger. For no reason. He was about 14. Abruptly, I drove on, back out towards Highway 78, past the scattered farms and gentle slopes that I knew like my own left leg. It was the first time in my life that I had turned my back on a place knowing that I would never see it again. It was all very sad. But I should have known better. As I always used to tell Thomas Wolfe, there are three things you just can't do in life. You can't beat the phone company, you can't make a waiter see you until he's ready to see you, and you can't go home again. Chapter 3. I drove on, without the radio or much in the way of thoughts, to Mount Pleasant, where I stopped for coffee. I had the Sunday New York Times with me. One of the greatest improvements in life since I had been away was that you could now buy the New York Times out of machines on the day of publication in a place like Iowa. An extraordinary feat of distribution. And I spread out with it in a booth. Boy, do I love the Sunday New York Times. Apart from its many virtues as a newspaper, there is just something wonderfully reassuring about its very bulk. The issue in front of me must have weighed 10 or 12 pounds. It could have stopped a bullet at 20 yards. I read once that it takes 75,000 trees to produce one issue of the Sunday New York Times, and it's well worth every trembling leaf. So what if our grandchildren have no oxygen to breathe? Fuck 'em! My favorite parts of the Times are the peripheral bits, the parts that are so dull and obscure that they exert a kind of hypnotic fascination, like the home improvements column, all you need to know about fixings and fastenings. And the stamps column, post office marks 25 years of aeronautic issues. Above all, I love the advertising supplements. If a Bulgarian asked me what life was like in America, I would, without hesitation, tell him to get hold of a stack of New York Times advertising supplements. They show a life of richness and variety beyond the wildest dreams of most foreigners. As if to illustrate my point, the issue before me contained a gift catalog from the Zwingle Company of New York, offering scores of products of the things you never knew you needed variety. Musical shoe trees, an umbrella with a transistor radio in the handle, an electric nail buffer. What a great country! My favorite was a small electric hot plate you could put on your desk to keep your coffee from going cold. This must be a real boon to people with brain damage, the sort of injuries that lead them to wander off and neglect their beverages. And epileptics all over America must be feeling equally grateful. Dear Zwingle Company, I can't tell you how many times I have come around from a grand mal seizure to find myself lying on the floor thinking, "Oh, God, I bet my coffee's gone cold again." Really, who buys these things? Silver toothpicks and monogrammed underpants and mirrors that say Man of the Year on them. I have often thought that if I ran one of these companies, I would produce a polished mahogany plaque with a brass plate on it saying, "Hey, how about me? I paid $22.95 for this completely useless piece of crap." I'm certain they would sell like hotcakes. Once in a deranged moment, I bought something myself from one of these catalogs, knowing deep in my mind that it would end in heartbreak. It was a little reading light that you clipped onto your book so as not to disturb your bedmate as she slumbered beside you. In this respect, it was outstanding because it barely worked. The light it cast was absurdly feeble. In the catalog, it looked like the sort of thing you could signal ships with if you got lost at sea, and left all but the first two lines of a page in darkness. I have seen more luminous insects. After about 4 minutes, its little beam fluttered and failed altogether, and it has never been used again. And the thing is that I knew all along that this was how it was going to end, that it would all be a bitter disappointment. On second thought, if I ever ran one of those companies, I would just send people an empty box with a note in it saying, "We have decided not to send you the item you've ordered, because, as you well know, it would never properly work, and you would only be disappointed. So let this be a lesson to you for the future." From the Zwingle catalog, I moved on to the food and household products advertisements. There is usually a wodge of these bright and glossy inducements to try out exciting new products. Things with names like Hunk of Meat Beef Stew and Gravy, with Rich and Meaty Chunks of Beef Textured Fiber, and Sniffa Snacks, an exciting new snack treat you take through the nose, and Country Sunshine Honey Toasted Wheat Nut and Sugar Bits Breakfast Cereal, now with vitamin-enriched chocolate-covered raisin substitute. I am endlessly fascinated by these new products. Clearly, some time ago, makers and consumers of American junk food passed jointly through some kind of sensibility barrier in the endless quest for new taste sensations. Now they're a little like those desperate junkies who have tried every known drug and are finally reduced to mainlining toilet bowl cleanser in an effort to get still higher. All over America, you can see countless flabby-butted couples quietly searching supermarket shelves for new combinations of flavors, hoping to find some untried product that will tingle in their mouths and excite, however briefly, their leaden taste buds. The competition for this market is intense. The food inserts not only offered 50-cent discounts and the like, but also if you sent off two or three labels, the manufacturers would dispatch to you a Hunk of Meat Beach Towel, or Country Sunshine Matching Apron and Oven Mitt, or a Sniffa Snacks hot plate for keeping your coffee warm while you slipped in and out of consciousness from a surfeit of blood sugar. Interestingly, the advertisements for dog food were much the same, except that they weren't usually chocolate-flavored. In fact, every single product, from the lemon-scented toilet bowl cleansers to the Scentopine trash bags, promised to give you a brief buzz. It's no wonder that so many Americans have a glazed look. They're completely junked out. I drove on south on Highway 218 to Keokuk. This stretch of the road was marked on my map as a scenic route, though these things are decidedly relative. Talking about a scenic route in southeast Iowa is like talking about a good Barry Manilow album. You have to make certain allowances. Compared with an afternoon in a darkened room, it wasn't bad. But compared with, say, the coast road along the Sorrentine Peninsula, it was perhaps a little tame. Certainly, it didn't strike me as being any more or less scenic than any of the other roads I had been on today. Keokuk is a Mississippi River town where Iowa, Illinois, and Missouri face each other across a broad bend in the river. I was heading towards Hannibal in Missouri, and was hoping to see a bit of the town en route to the bridge south, but before I knew it, I found myself on a bridge going east to Illinois. I was so disconcerted by this that I only caught a glimpse of the river, a glistening smear of brown stretching off in two directions. And then, chagrined, I was in Illinois. I had really looked forward to seeing the Mississippi. Crossing it as a child had always been an adventure. Dad would call, "Here's the Mississippi, kids!" And we would scramble to the window to find ourselves on a bridge practically in the clouds, so high it made our breath catch, and the silvery river far, far below, wide, majestic, serene, going about its timeless business of just rolling on. You could see for miles, a novel experience in Iowa. You could see barges and islands and riverside towns. It looked wonderful. And then abruptly you were in Illinois, and it was flat and full of corn, and you realized with a sinking heart that that was it. That was your visual stimulation for the day. Now you had hundreds more miles of arid cornland to cross before you would experience even the most fractional sense of pleasure. And now here I was in Illinois, and it was flat and full of corn and boring. A childlike voice in my head cried, "When are we going to be there? I'm bored. Let's go home. When are we going to be there?" Having confidently expected at this stage to be in Missouri, I had my book of maps open to the Missouri page, so I pulled over to the side of the road, in a state of some petulance, to make a cartographical adjustment. A sign just ahead of me said, "Buckle up. It's," without an apostrophe, "the law in Illinois." Clearly, however, it was not an offense to be unable to punctuate. Frowning, I studied my maps. If I turned off at Hamilton, just down the road, I could drive along the east bank of the river and cross into Missouri at Quincy. It was even marked on the map as a scenic route. Perhaps my blundering would turn out to be no bad thing. I followed the road through Warsaw, a run-down little river town. A steep hill plunged down towards the river, but then turned inland, and again I caught no more than a glimpse of the river. Almost immediately the landscape spread out into a broad, alluvial plain. The sun was sinking in the sky. To the left hills rose up, flecked with trees that were just beginning to show a blush of autumn color. To the right the land was as flat as a tabletop. Teams of combine harvesters labored in the fields, kicking up dust, working late to bring in the harvest. In the far distance, grain elevators caught the fading sun and glowed an opalescent white as if lit from within. Somewhere out there, unseen, was the river. I drove on. The road was completely unsignposted. They do this to you a lot in America, particularly on country roads that go from nowhere to nowhere. You're left to rely on your own sense of direction to find your way, which in my case, let us not forget, had only recently delivered me to the wrong state. I calculated that if I were going south, the sun should be to my right, a conclusion I reached by imagining myself in a tiny car driving across a big map of America. But the road twisted and wandered, causing the sun to drift teasingly in front of me, first to this side of the road, then to that. For the first time all day, I had a sense of being in the heart of a vast continent in the middle of nowhere. Abruptly, the highway turned to gravel. Gypsum nuggets, jagged as arrowheads, flew up against the underside of the car and made a fearful din. I had visions of hose pipes rupturing, hot oil spraying everywhere, me rolling to a steamy, hissing halt out here on this desolate road. The wandering sun was just settling onto the horizon, splashing the sky with faint pinks. Uneasily, I drove on, and steeled myself for the prospect of a night spent beneath the stars, with dog-like animals sniffing at my feet and snakes finding warmth up a trouser leg. Ahead of me on the road, an advancing storm of dust became, after a moment, a pickup truck, which passed in a hell-bent fashion, spraying the car with rocky projectiles, which thumped against the sides and bounced off the windows with a cracking sound, and then left me adrift in a cloud of dust. I trundled on, peering helplessly through the murk. It cleared just in time to show me that I was 20 feet from a T-junction with a stop sign. I was going 50 miles an hour, which on gravel leaves you with a stopping distance of about 3 miles. I jumped on the brakes with all my feet and made a sound like Tarzan missing a vine as the car went into a skid. It slid sideways past the stop sign and out onto a paved highway, where it came to a halt, rocking gently from side to side. At that moment, an enormous semi-trailer truck, all silver horns and flashing lights, blared mightily at me as it swept past, setting the car rocking again. Had I slid out onto the highway 3 seconds earlier, it would have crushed the car into something about the size of a stock cube. I pulled onto the shoulder and got out to examine the damage. It looked as if the car had been dive-bombed with bags of flour. Bits of raw metal showed through where the paint had been pinged away. I thank God that my mother was so much smaller than me. I sighed, suddenly feeling lost and far from home, and noticed ahead a road sign pointing the way to Quincy. I had come to a halt, facing in the right direction, so at least something had come of it. It was time to stop. Just down the road stood a little town, which I shall call Dullard, lest the people recognize themselves and take me to court, or come to my house and batter me with baseball bats. On the edge of town was an old motel which looked pretty seedy, though judging by the absence of charred furniture in the front yard, it was clearly a step up from the sort of place my dad would have chosen. I pulled onto the gravel drive and went inside. A woman of about 75 was sitting behind the desk. She wore butterfly glasses and a beehive hairdo. She was doing one of those books that require you to find words in a mass of letters and circle them. I think it was called Word Puzzles for Morons.
"Help you?"
she drawled without looking up. "I'd like a room for the night, please."
"That'll be $38.50,"
she replied as her pen fell greedily on the word yup. I was nonplussed. In my day, a motel room cost about $12. "I don't want to buy the room," I explained. "I just want to sleep in it for one night." She looked at me gravely over the tops of her glasses.
"The room is $38.50 per night. Plus tax. You want it or not?"
She had one of those disagreeable accents that add a syllable to every word. Tax came out as tax. We both knew that I was miles from anywhere. "Yes, please," I said contritely. I signed in and crunched across the gravel to my suite de nuit. There appeared to be no other customers. I went into my room with my bag and had a look around, as you do in a new place. There was a black-and-white TV which appeared to get only one channel, and 3 bent coat hangers. The bathroom mirror was cracked, and the shower curtains didn't match. The toilet seat had a strip of paper across it saying, "Sanitized for your protection," but floating beneath it was a cigarette butt, adrift in a little circle of nicotine. Dad would have liked it here, I thought. I had a shower. That is to say, water dribbled onto my head from a nozzle in the wall, and afterwards went out to check out the town. I had a meal of gristle and baked wiffle ball at a place called, aptly, Chuck's. I didn't think it was possible to get a truly bad meal anywhere in the Midwest, but Chuck managed to provide it. It was the worst food I had ever had. And remember, I've lived in Britain. It had all the attributes of chewing gum, except flavor. Even now, when I burp, I can taste it. Afterwards, I had a look around the town. There wasn't much. It was mostly just one street, with a grain silo and railroad tracks at one end, and my motel at the other, with a couple of gas stations and grocery stores in between. Everyone regarded me with interest. Years ago, in the midst of a vivid and impressionable youth, I read a chilling story by Richard Matheson about a remote hamlet whose inhabitants waited every year for a lone stranger to come to town so that they could roast him for their annual barbecue. The people here watched me with barbecue eyes. Feeling self-conscious, I went into a dark place called Vern's Tap and took a seat at the bar. I was the only customer, apart from an old man in the corner with only one leg. The barmaid was friendly. She wore butterfly glasses and a beehive hairdo. You could see in an instant that she had been the local good-time girl since about 1931. She had "Ready for Sex" written all over her face, but better bring a paper bag written all over her body. Somehow she had managed to pour her capacious backside into some tight red toreador pants, and to stretch a clinging blouse over her bosom. She looked as if she had dressed in her granddaughter's clothes by mistake. She was about 60. It was pretty awful. I could see why the guy with one leg had chosen to sit in the farthest corner. I asked her what people in Dullard did for fun.
"What exactly did you have in mind, honey?"
she said, and rolled her eyes suggestively. The ready-for-sex signs flickered, an occurrence I found unsettling. I wasn't used to being hustled by women, though somehow I'd always known that when the moment came it would be in some place like downstate Illinois with a 60-year-old grandmother. "Well, perhaps something in the way of legitimate theater, or maybe an international chess congress," I croaked weakly. However, once we established that I was only prepared to love her for her mind, she became quite sensible, and even rather charming. She told me in great and frank detail about her life, which seemed to have involved a dizzying succession of marriages to guys who were now in prison, or dead, as a result of shootouts, and dropped in breathtakingly candid disclosures like,
"Nah, Jimmy killed his mother. I never did know why. But Curtis never killed nobody except once by accident when he was robbing a gas station and his gun went off. And Floyd, he was my fourth husband. He never killed nobody either. But he used to break people's arms if they got him riled."
"You must have some interesting family reunions," I ventured politely.
"I don't know whatever became of Floyd," she went on. "He had a little cleft in his chin right year."
After a moment I realized that this